Okay.
Yeah. Hi, everyone. How are you today?
Good.
Excellent. So we're here today to talk about modern game accessibility, changing sympathy to solution. There we go. Look at that. And just as a quick disclaimer, we sincerely hope this presentation is beneficial to everyone. But as a caveat, much of what we're going to discuss today came from our experiences working with Naughty Dog and building Uncharted 4 and Uncharted The Lost Legacy. And our current project, The Last of Us Part 2. Want to go goals?
Sure, you want to give us the first one? So really what we're trying to do here is just to tell you a little bit about the process that we went through at Naughty Dog. We had a really great situation there because it really wasn't a lot about the two of us trying to bring accessibility to Naughty Dog. It was about Naughty Dog trying to bring accessibility to their game. And we were just in a really good place at a good time and tried to sort of add to that by doing some of these things. We tried to really give them some boosts where they needed them. For one, although there was a lot of excitement about trying to make the game more accessible, there were some ways in which certain parts of the team could use a little more understanding of accessibility issues, so changing the perception of accessibility. We really wanted to give the development partners there at Naughty Dog the opportunity to understand what people needed. And also, we had the benefit of having a lot of information from other successful games and from people who knew what to do in the accessibility world. And so we had some design principles available to us, and we from all of the industry, really. And we wanted to try to update those to the Naughty Dog situation, try to help them with that. And finally, to also provide some methodology for going about trying to make the game more accessible. There wasn't a real understanding of what a process would be for trying to bring some of these things to the game. So that's another thing we tried to work on there. Then, of course, there are best practices from all the people in this room that I see, all the smiling faces, and from people all over the world, thank you, that are smiling along.
That's a good way to go.
Yeah.
So who are we? Handsome, yes. Kevin? So,
I'm a user researcher, meaning that I don't really in particular know anything about accessibility, but I have been trying to make products more usable for the past 25 years, and that's really what I bring to this. And I had the great pleasure of working with Sam in a production capability. I'll let Sam tell you a little bit more about
you blood high blush. So my name is Sam Thompson. I'm a managing senior producer for Worldwide Studios. I've been working with Naughty Dog since the days of Crash 2 when I was a tester for that product, and have come through the ranks over the years. I also have not 25, 20 years experience working with Sony. I started back in 1998 when we were on the PS1. And of course, outside of the Naughty Dog franchises, I've also worked with Resistance, Siphon Filter, Spyro, Crash, and Sly Cooper.
Cool. I was going to have like this big scrolling list of all the games that I worked on.
Yes.
But then
it became an arms race.
Have more games.
Yeah. I'm really sure there are a lot of other people in here that have more than us. But, so we all want accessibility. And that's the bottom line.
The other thing we'd like to point out is that what we were able to do on the Naughty Dog game and what we're going to talk about today really is part of a larger wave. Hopefully Ian talked about this earlier this morning. I like to be part of that wave of trying to bring more accessibility to games. And so this is something that I think really is, there are a lot of opportunities for it. And so when we talk about all these things today, we're not trying to tell you, probably almost certainly not telling you anything new, not trying to tell you
something. No, we're totally telling about a new stuff.
Are there some new things?
Yeah, there is.
Okay, good. You probably put some in late last night or something like that.
I did.
In any case, You know, Microsoft is out there doing great work. EA is out there doing great. All kinds of people are out there doing great work. And when we see quotes like this, it's extremely heartwarming for us. It really lets us know that we're in this together to try to make games that everyone can play.
We wrote something fancy, which is, there's a revolution led by empowered development teams and publishers that is pushing the boundaries of accessibility and transcending traditional console boundaries. I didn't want to waste that.
No, that's very fancy. There. I like that.
So our first kind of point that we wanted to discuss is use DevSpeak to increase ownership. And a lot of what we do is kind of like Caesar Milan here in Dog Whisperer. I don't know how many people have played this title, but the play on words is what we're looking for. You know, Naughty Dog, Dog Whisperer, that kind of thing. See what we did. There's a great quote from Alex. She's wonderful, and she's really kind of pointing out the urgency for what the dev teams are looking at and where we are in this process and understanding when in the pipeline they need to start doing it. And it's been kind of a common thread today that I've heard. James spoke of it earlier, and there's been some other folks that spoke referred to it as well. And this is basically saying that we need to do it right away. The moment you start with your first prototype, the first gray box, sandbox level you have, you need to start thinking about accessibility. And so how does that fit into the development process? Well, some things to consider when approaching this concept of accessibility with your dev team is to allow the dev teams to prioritize features based on team strength. And then you want to work within your dev schedule and you want to test that and your test schedule as well. Both of these things are absolute. If you're building features and systems, but you're not actually aligning them with your development schedule, then you're not going to have any way of prototyping them and validating them to see if they're effective. One of the great things that we were able to do with Uncharted 4 and UTLL was to design all of our accessibility features in lockstep with our production schedule, which helped us tremendously. Another thing to consider is consider resources, scope, and budget. Everything has to come within your everything has to come within the team flexibility to be able to implement and iterate on these features. So if you don't have the manpower assigned, if you don't have the budget, if you don't have the scope, then you have to go back and rethink that feature. You have to go back and talk to your team to try to figure out how you're going to make this work. Believe in the flexibility of implementation. Just because the first implementation doesn't work, the first iteration may have a ton of bugs, but it's how you iterate of that over time that's going to get you to the promised land and where you need to be with that feature. And nothing is worth throwing away. There's always something good through playing with different implementations and seeing how they work within the larger systemic universe. One of the things we're going to show you today is kind of the work that we did with the lockpicking system on UTLL. And this was a new system that was added to the Lost Legacy after Uncharted 4 shipped. And it was using kind of this haptic feedback early on where you have to use the analog stick to kind of find the sweet spot in the different lock pistons so that you can unlock each one in order. But the first iteration of this was, we already knew that this was going to be an accessibility nightmare and that what it was requiring was a fine motor skill engagement that a lot of people actually wouldn't have. It would be really demanding on players. So by aligning this with design very early, we were able to do about 6 months worth of iteration. We work with consultants like Josh and other folks to come into the studio and actually play test this for us and take that into usable iterations that we eventually were able to find a real solution for. This first iteration, for example, displayed a range that would visually shrink over time. You had to keep the cursor within that range to succeed. A few weeks later, we had a range that would move around and kind of the player would have to chase it, which was no good. And if you made one mistake in the whole process, you would go all the way back to the beginning, which is punishing for the player because it would take them at times 15 to 20 minutes to successfully pick that lock, which was crazy. I think we actually have a video demonstrating some of this stuff, maybe not.
Yeah, we do. It is going to kind of show you where the feature ended up.
Well, no, this is the very first. So, and ignore the dates. We had to go back to old builds and recapture.
It's not the video.
No, this is the very first one I thought. Yeah, this is old school. So then the next iteration. So that's showing kind of an early iteration, what we tried to do. It didn't work out too well for us. We had a lot of feedback, like maybe it was too simple. The second iteration, it wouldn't reset right. The point here is that we went too far the other direction of oversimplifying the mechanic. The first feedback we had on the initial implementation was that it was way too difficult. There were too many systems at play that were causing problems for the consumer. We went too far the other direction. Once again, there were problems. If we would have been at the end of the development cycle, we would have had to ship like this and it would have been done. But luckily for us, we had more time to iterate, luckily. And with that, we found kind of a happy medium where you still feel around. You can no longer fail a tumbler if you go past it. More tumblers added, locks as you progress. Some locks inherently have more tumblers than others. Anyway, we used a lot of data to come up with a system that was much more appropriate.
No. Is that the last one? Almost. There's a couple more in the alley.
Gripping. Gripping.
I mean, one of the really obvious things you can see here in that video is just the transition from earlier stages where we were relying entirely on vibration in order
haptic
to
feedback.
Tell what was going on. And now in these later iterations, even at a high level, that you can see that you've got visual feedback as well as the tactile feedback, as well as as well as some subtle audio feedback that is going to be helpful for people as well.
So the key items here are essentially synchronize approaching the problem with your team, implementation schedule of the mechanic. You want to align usability testing with your production schedule to reinforce data-driven decision-making. And sunk versus opportunity cost. You want to invest the team into the process of creating the right decision, the right mechanic on the onset versus trying to retrofit a mechanic after the fact, because it's far cheaper to do it through your development schedule than to have to go back and try to fix things 3 weeks for final when you're dealing with a lot of other big issues that you're trying to tackle.
And I don't think we would have got there if we hadn't learned what we learned from Uncharted 4 either, so that we were ready at the start of The Lost Legacy to take a look at all of the different mechanics, especially the ones that were unusual from the core mechanics, and say, what are going to be the issues here? And let's pay special attention to those things. So again, fitting into the schedule and thinking about it ahead of time and learning from your mistakes, very useful. So now I'd like to show you a little different thing. One of the things that we have access to are some great set of best practices and guidelines from Mark Friend, works at Sony also. And part of it that was particularly influential for us was this drawing that Mark made about the different kinds of disabilities, I guess, that are the standard or expected disabilities that you might want to solve for. They're grouped into three different categories because if you go to the next little bit, you'll see that Mark has translated these things into different kinds of parts of the game experience, essentially. So he's grouped vision issues and audio issues together as issues that have to do with problems receiving a stimulus or taking in some element of what the game is trying to tell you. Of course, in the middle, you do some processing, and that's where you might see some difficulties. People have cognitive issues. And then there are also issues potentially in the response that a person has to it. So being able to provide your input if you have motor difficulties or speech difficulties, that's a place where you may have difficulty providing an input. It's a subtle shift in the way that you look at disability issues, but it's very powerful for us because what we then were able to do is think about this from the standpoint of the different disciplines that we work with at Naughty Dog and start to try to find owners for issues that exist so people could feel, again, empowered to take on something. One of the things that we really noticed is that we all want accessibility, but not everyone knows how to go about it, and a lot of people are looking for guidance and for leadership, or at least understanding when it's their problem, when it is something that they should be doing something about or finding a solution for. And so breaking down the issues that you witness that are accessibility problems, and talking about what kind of issue it is for the experience, and then giving it to the person whose job it is to make that experience good, can be a very important first step.
One of Tara's presentations, I believe last year, showed the Evolves team list of accessibility features and how they kind of stack ranked everything. And one of the problems that we found at the Naughty Dog side was that those terminologies can be really overwhelming. And when you're trying to explain different disability segments and what these different things mean, finding ownership within the team is virtually impossible. So to be able to translate that to DevSpeak and say, okay, it's UX, it's a system designer, it's a gameplay designer, now we can actually make meaningful progress in trying to address these issues.
And it's actually kind of comforting for the team to be like, oh, that's my issue. Good,
exactly.
I
Great.
Got it.
Now I can
we'll do something about that.
Exactly.
So another thing that we noticed, when we're trying to go out and look at all of the great ideas that are out there for how to try to manage accessibility issues, is that in some cases, there can be some rejection of potential solutions because they're prescribing design, or they're sort of telling the designer what to do or how to solve a particular problem. And if you work in the games industry for more than a little while, you'll realize that telling a designer what to do is not very effective.
Yeah.
But they're great at solving problems, and they really want to. They just want to figure out how they're going to do
that. They
want
to be empowered to do it themselves.
Yeah, empowered to do it themselves. So I'm just going to tell a quick story about saving. And one of the things that I've seen out in the world is, and I've done this myself, is complain about save points or the lack thereof. It can be very painful for any user, and it can be especially painful if maybe you need to go more slowly through a process, or you need to take your time and master something and then move on to the next thing. So if, like me, you've seen a number of people suggest that a great solution to a save point problem would be to allow people to save everywhere, then you may also have seen some of the comments that come back after that suggestion is made. A lot of comments say, well, no, there's a save point there for a reason. There are saving when you choose to allow the player to save their progress or to spawn or respawn from a death or from some experience, it's a very important part of the challenge design in a game very often. So, another observation I was making is that people do have a tendency when they're thinking about trying to make a solution to a problem to want to redo it completely from scratch. No, I've got a great plan for this. I don't know why they had that plan in the first place. We just have to throw it all out and start over brand new, or use this different model, the save everywhere model. And it also may not be completely obvious that saving a game at any point in time would be a big change to the fundamental way that most games are coded and developed. It would be a huge architectural change. So what we're suggesting is that if you're thinking about this kind of model, it might be more appropriate to take a look at the design, figure out the places where the design is not working, so those spots where you maybe have to run for miles and miles after dying just to get back to the point where you can jump off the cliff the wrong way again, or in a boss battle, perhaps it's extremely difficult for a long period of time, and when you finally get past 75% of that boss battle and then die, you don't want to go back and do the entire thing. Those are examples of things where the save point is tedious. They can be determined. Go tell the designer that save point in particular is tedious and let them figure out a way to deal with that problem, as opposed to thinking first of changing the whole architecture.
Save when needed.
Save when needed.
There you go. That's it. So again, that's reinforcing the principle that if you build enough time in your schedule and you're working with your design team, all of these things you could iterate over time through usability testing. For the last project alone, I think we spent about 25 weeks at the studio testing the product. So we have, from Graybox, from very early on, we have the ability to prototype and fully test a lot of different directions on a lot of different features. And this provides us a lot of flexibility in terms of experimentation as well as final implementation. So it's key that you start early and try to dedicate enough time over the schedule to fully iterate on those features. One of the great folks that we met last year at the GA conference was Brandon Cole. And Brandon Cole is visually impaired, and he had a great talk about his experiences playing games and what he looks for in the products. And Alex and Em, we were very taken by his presentation, and so we asked him to come out to the studio and to spend some time with the design team and actually show them how he plays the games that he had talked about, and then have him play our games a little bit and really start a dialogue as to how we can make Silas Gaming possible in our future products. And it was just, in order to really kind of generate momentum on the team level, you have to empower and you have to inspire them. And the way to do that is to get folks into the studio and actually show them examples of how folks have found ways to play games with unintended accessibility. And with this in mind, we have a video that we'd like to share of his play session.
I'll demonstrate that too. We actually are doing the thing. Because if you notice, sound effect. And announcer dialogue there. But if I move to another character, oh no, that's not the right one. Oh, there we go.
Loading.
Maybe we should. Not sure.
It says 2 minutes. Okay. I'd rather skip part of mine.
Nope.
We're gonna watch one more round just because it's so impressive.
Guy. Yeah, I have no mercy for Blanche. Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. I'm glad I was able to help you out there. It's actually not what I was initially going for. There is a really awesome brutality I was going to try to do. It was not being very nice about it, so I was like, all right, you're done.
All of those elements, including the trophy popping up at the end there, have a sound effect associated with them, and that's the way that Brandon's able to do that. And his ability to show us this so elegantly is just incredibly powerful as a way to get people in the studio to see what we're talking about and to see what they're trying to accomplish.
Right, to empower the team to make change. Once it demystifies everything that they're trying to conceptualize, they can see it firsthand, and then it's a call to action. Yeah. And people are still energized from that visit months and months later, which is really great.
So there are an array
five
of...
5 minutes.
5 minutes left? Okay.
Yeah.
So there's a number of features in here, and one thing that we really wanted to point out is another example of this is having Josh Straub talk with people in the studio and talk with us and point out some of the issues that he faces has been very influential and kind of eye-opening to try to understand what some of the things are that can be changed. Repeated button presses is a good example of something that was blocking a person Josh, in this case, from finishing the game. And we were able to change that once we knew where it is, so that it could be made into a toggle. Another point to make is that not all of the changes that you're going to want to, or all of the custom features that you might want to provide for people are going to be applicable all the time in your game. So in Uncharted, there's a lot of combat with a gun, but there's also a lot of driving around, and they're intermixed. And one of the original ways that we had for making the game more accessible was to be able to swap sticks, it was called, which meant that you could control things that usually were controlled by the left stick with the right stick. And that was very helpful to Josh in particular because of his particular accessibility issues. And but what was not so helpful is that when you swap the sticks, it makes it so that it's really good for aiming, which you could then do on the left stick instead of the right stick, but it's really bad for driving because driving is controlled by the movement stick, which is the right stick, so that was flipping it away from where Josh wanted to control it. So instead, doctoring this, the solution was not really very complicated. It was just making sure that this change only occurred in those cases where you want it to occur. And but you know, we never would have known that if we didn't have this dialogue with Josh, with gamers who have issues and try to really understand what they are, because we were making a lot of assumptions about what the right thing to do was based on limited knowledge, I'm guessing. Another interesting point is, again, this was really brought home by our interactions with Josh. Was kind of going through actually making up a list of things to really focus on for the team with Lost Legacy. And I was kind of making the same mistake that I'd made before, again, thinking about an imaginary a person, basically, had a particular need in mind, which was to use the stick one-handed, or to use the controller one-handed, and I believe that that meant that they would want to have lock-on aiming, as well as being able to swap which stick was in control, as well as perhaps camera assist or other this other collection of stuff. And in fact, I was really wrong again. About wanting to necessarily use all of those things for all people who had that particular condition. Because, as it turns out, in Josh's case, he didn't want to use lock-on aiming because it's a very important part of the game. Aiming is fun and challenging, and it's a big part of the experience. And he didn't want to use lock-on aiming if he didn't have to. And he didn't have to, as long as he had some of these other things. And we saw this again in spades when we brought in six people one day to play the game and give us feedback, and I think they all had small motor issues. And of those six, something like four or five of them didn't use any of the features that we had created with them in mind, with that particular disability in mind. And it was for the same set of reasons that Josh made me fully understand so eloquently. It's because they had, aiming was a core part of the experience. A lock-on actually can be a disadvantage because it doesn't give you a chance to have a headshot, and headshots are very useful in combat. And then finally, all of these people had been struggling with these issues for a long time, and they'd figured out their own ways to deal with it. So they didn't need that particular feature. Not that we were gonna take it out, because there are other people who may, but we needed to provide enough subtlety that people could choose the right thing at the right time for the right person.
We're gonna skip through that.
Okay.
And for observation of time, we're gonna move a little bit quicker and hopefully we can cram everything in. I just talk way too slowly, it's my own fault. Broaden your thinking about accessibility. A great quote by Amelia, I'm sure you've heard it before. Identify core disciplines that can help promote your initiatives. And this is just knowing who to talk to within the team, right? If it's a UI artist, a system designer, gameplay design, understand the people that can best spearhead your initiatives. Usage percentage aren't always the best way to empower the team. A lot of analytics are great, but sometimes those percentages can be deceiving. So make sure that you understand in what context you're using usage percentages, because sometimes 2.8% adoption isn't a negative thing, it's a positive thing. But if you position it incorrectly, it will be perceived incorrectly. And then of course find champions to spearhead initiatives, and 5 ways to connect with your team to make it meaningful. Really quickly, I think Jason and I were on the same page. We also know Clint Lexa and have coordinated, and he's awesome, and we're just gonna leave it at that. Let's see. So a couple more things, make the issues relatable. The whole point of the Clint Lexa thing was our QA group is really into games done quickly. They were able to really get excited about this. They knew Clint was a big accessibility gamer. Hi, Jason. And so all of this stuff was working out really well, and we were able to really empower our QA team, who then kind of spread infectiously out to the other departments because they were so empowered by speedrunning. Focus on the barriers instead of disabilities. Going back to Kevin's original slide, if you could speak to it and democratize it in a way that positions it as accessibility for everyone, they will move much more quickly in adopting those principles. Identify merge to moments to encourage the team contribution. At one point when we had an accessibility group, we had a speaker who was only Spanish speaking only. And because we stream all of the accessibility tests throughout the department, we had an artist that came over and wasn't really engaged in accessibility, but saw it streaming at his desk and was like, I can totally speak Spanish, I can help you out here. And he really got invested in the moment, and he did some great work.
Turns out he was very invested in accessibility.
There you go.
He just didn't even know what was happening until that moment.
He didn't know. We're not gonna, you know, we're gonna talk just, well, Assassin's Creed, the whole discovery mode we love, we think it's great. We were talking about broadening your thinking about difficulty settings. We're doing a lot of work at Naughty Dog tracking difficulty play, where people die, how they die. We have a lot of analytics that we run. I would encourage everyone to kind of throw away the convention of traditional difficulty settings. I think we need to evolve as a group. There's a whole bunch more work we can do with puzzle difficulty, wayfinding difficulty, customizing combat, bespoke, a lot of what Jason talked about. Again, we're sharing a mind today. Bespoke gameplay modes like driving or swimming, things like that. And then you can race through the rest of these.
You're doing such a good job.
Yeah, here you go.
No, I'm scared.
You can do this.
Music on your gut.
Right? Yeah. That's, oh, we're 2 minutes over. We got to hurry.
Okay. So mentioned this before. Really, the essential idea is just that we're really talking about fixing issues in the game, not people. All these people are the same. You all know this. I've seen other people make these points before. But you know, a gamer has difficulty hearing is essentially the same as a gamer with a sleeping baby in the next room, or a gamer that's playing during a boring lecture, for example. One thing that we're gonna try to do more of in the future then is to bring people in to...
yeah, do stuff and things.
Bring people in.
Recruit for issues.
Who have specific issues, not because they have a particular impairment, because we've seen before that an impairment doesn't necessarily mean an ability to do something. And so. We're going to try and do that in the future.
Oh, Lordy.
We also...
stuff and things.
Stuff and things. This is a good point, actually, they all are. When we brought those 6 people in, and 5 of them didn't play the game, we found that they were actually also not aware that the features were actually there. So they didn't have the expectation that these accessibility features would be available. And that led to lots of ways of trying to highlight them, including putting a lot of these features, or some of the biggest features, into the startup sequence of the game so that they would be perceived as elements of playing the game for everyone, not as things that need to be hidden away in an options menu somewhere. Have we finally got through?
We have.
Yes.
We're in a good place.
And yes, you can see the slides and read those later. But thank you so much for bearing with us. And
there it is. Thank you all. Thank you.